Chicago Symphony Orchestra was conducted by Pierre Monteur, and that's about it for this edition of Sunday Morning. Thank you so much for your company. I do hope you've enjoyed today's selection of music. My one-off symphony next week is something of an epic by a composer known primarily for just one work, Paul Dukas, his 41-minute symphony in C. So please do join me same time next Sunday morning, 9 o'clock.
Sunday Morning with Rob Cowan is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production this morning by Lyndon Jones.
Discover the great composers on the BBC Radio 3 website. Choose from over 1,000 programmes about the lives and works of some of the greatest classical composers.
Britain said this was simple music that people would either like or not.
There are opera guides, building a library, composer of the week, the story of music and much more.
I think that the justification for Mahler is this is a work of art.
Salome was a colossal success for Strauss.
It's a pocket piano concerto in which Gershwin himself would have been the soloist.
People often speak of Beethoven's late quartets with this very hushed, reverential tone.
Open up a world of music from Radio 3 by going to bbc.co.uk/greatcomposers.
Well, now it's time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the scientist and tango dancer Nicky Clayton.
My guest today says that she spent most of her life wondering what it would be like to be a bird, to fly, to see colours in the ultraviolet, and to sing as beautifully as they do. Nicky Clayton is a fellow of the Royal Society and professor of comparative cognition at Cambridge, and she's probably done more than any other scientist to transform the way we think about animal intelligence, and particularly the intelligence of birds. She spent the last 25 years observing magpies, jackdaws, jays, and every species of crow, watching them as they play tricks on each other and sing and dance together. Her work has challenged the assumption that only humans have the intelligence to plan for the future and reminisce about the past, that only humans can really understand the minds of others. So, Nicky, what you've revealed in many ways is that these birds are fantastically intelligent, that they're as intelligent as chimpanzees.
That's right. These birds, members of the crow family, we sometimes call them corvids, have huge brains for their body size. Relatively speaking, they're as big as chimpanzees. And in pretty much every single test that we've compared them in, they really come out on a par with the chimpanzees. They're fabulous at problem solving, they're fabulous at trickery, and they have wonderful memories and an astonishing ability to plan ahead. So much so that my husband, Dr. Nathan Emery, who was trained as a primatologist and then studied cognition in crows, as I do, has argued that when it comes to thinking, these birds are the feathered apes.
Well, many composers have been inspired by bird song, so it's no surprise that for your first music, Nicky, you've chosen the calls of some of the birds you've been working with. Tell us what it is.
Yes, I suppose my PhD was in birdsong learning, and I studied how zebrafinches learn their songs. Zebrafinches don't have terribly attractive songs, so instead I've picked a bird that has a more interesting, complex song, the reed warbler. And then we're going to have a little bit of Messiaen's The Reed Warbler and just see how amazingly accurately he's able to capture the songs and calls.
Well, the extraordinary thing was he had an ear that could, as it were, slow down these sounds to notate them. Because I think at actual speed, it'd be very difficult, but he could do it. I mean, he actually had such an extraordinary acuity of hearing.
Yes, it's incredible. For most people, you really want to play it at half speed to be able to hear it.
Thank you. The Reed Warbler from Messiaen's Catalogue of Birds, performed by the composer's wife, Yvonne Loriot. And before that, we heard an actual Mr. or Mrs. Reed Warbler. Do they have different calls, actually? Could you distinguish one from the other?
Yes, yes. You would be able to distinguish individuals, yeah.
Do you think it was a gentleman or a lady we heard beforehand?
Gentleman.
Messiaen wrote that all melodic lines and rhythms in Catalogue d'Oiseaux are authentic. And could you see, because of course when artists take something like that, they also take it on to another level, don't they? And not just do it precisely the same, but there is a precision in his notation. And could you hear that?
Yes, absolutely.
And so tempo-wise, true to Birdsong.
Yes, yes.
One of your discoveries, Nicky Clayton, is that birds perceive time in a different way from us. And you found everything in the bird world is slightly speeded up, like their song.
Yeah, I think everything is sort of twice as fast as ours would be a rough approximation. So if you play those old films in black and white where you can see they're not smooth, but you can see the individual shots of them, if a bird were to watch normal film that we see now, they would see it like that.
Do you think that's because with flight and all the other things, they have over time developed faster reactions in order to survive?
And their brains are very different as well. I often use the analogy that you could imagine a human brain and a bird brain. They're made of the same stuff, neurons and glia. Now, in my analogy, it's cake mix. But whereas the human brain, and that of all mammals actually, has six layers to it. So it's like one of those Austrian chocolate cakes, the Sachertorte. Whereas the bird brain would be more like a fruitcake in the way it's made. So I think that's the other thing with it. Because you don't have to have layers, everything can be speeded up because the communication channels are so much faster.
And it is the quality, I think, that most of us would love to have, the ability to fly, isn't it?
Me particularly, it's been such an important thing. I've always wanted to fly. I think that's what got me so interested in dance. And just because you can't see them doesn't mean I don't have wings. They're just invisible.
Your next choice of music is a piece which I think reminds you of the pattern of bird flight, aerial ballet on the wing, as you've just suggested. It's by Respighi. And although he actually wrote an orchestral suite called The Birds, but what you've chosen is one of a series of pieces written in response to the series of paintings by Botticelli, and in this case, the famous Birth of Venus.
Well, actually, it's because the images that it triggered in my mind was not so much of the famous painting, but bizarrely, of a murmuration of starlings and their wonderful patterns, their aerial ballet on the wing. And the way I feel when I listen to it, it's as if sometimes the birds are near the horizon, sometimes they move closer to me or the viewer and listener's point of view. Then all of a sudden, they're overhead. And in the next minute, they're gone.
That extraordinary thing that starlings do when they all seem to turn at once and create a pattern in the sky. I mean, they could only do that through incredibly speeded-up brain power, wouldn't
they? That's right. I just don't see how you could do
it. And how do you think they communicate the, OK, turn right or turn left or port or starboard or whatever land words they use?
I don't know. I think the body awareness that they must have is incredible. And that's what allows them to maintain these very tight formations.
So the speeded-up brain takes on board the slightest movement, the quiver of the wing, and then they all move synchronously.
Yes, yes.
Thank you. I can see how that music does seem to have sustained lines that are sort of held aloft.
That's exactly what triggered it for me.
Laszlo Heltai conducting the Iago Chamber Orchestra in The Birth of Venus from Respighi's Botticelli triptych. You say, Nicky Clayton, that you're only a scientist by day, but by night you take on a much more exotic identity as a flying tango dancer.
How wonderful, yes. I love movement in many forms, but of all the dances, tango's arguably my favourite. I suppose I think of it as the poetry of movement and the dance of the shoes.
It's also quite sexy, isn't it?
Very passionate, isn't it? Yeah, very beautiful dance.
It's the sudden movements, isn't it? Which, of course, is a bit like Starlings as well.
Yes, there's sudden bits and there's the feeling of flying and then the sudden connection as you wrap your legs around one another. It's gorgeous.
So which piece have you chosen for us?
Well, I've chosen in particular a piece by Astor Piazzolla, Milonga of the
Angels.
He's
the kind of father of tango, isn't he? I mean, he's really brought it to a much bigger audience.
Yes, that's true. I mean, many pieces of tango were composed specifically for the dance hall, for the milonga. But Astor Piazzolla would argue that his pieces are really written for the concert hall.
I remember when I was in Brazil talking to the San Paolo Orchestra about tango, and they said, oh, that's Argentinian, we don't have anything to do with them. And I discovered when I researched this that tango actually started in Brazil and then became a sort of Argentinian speciality.
Ah, yeah, and I think it really grew in the whole Pampas area. So I think there are people in Uruguay who would also claim that the tango is not just Argentinian but Uruguayan too.
Thank you. Milonga de Langel by Astor Piazzolla, The Dance of an Angel. Yo-Yo Ma was the cellist, but perhaps the most important instrument in that sound world was the bandolion, a kind of squeeze box or accordion.
So beautiful. It just makes me want to get up and dance.
Tell me how birds dance, Nicky Clayton.
Oh, well, my favourite example is a bird called the manakin. And these are sort of sparrow-sized birds that live in Brazil and Uruguay and Argentina. And the wonderful thing about these birds is that the males do a double act when it comes to courtship. You get two male birds dancing together. One is the leader and the other is the follower. So it really does look a bit like avian tango.
And I think you discovered that females are reluctant to choose a mate without checking their credentials as the dancer first, which is all like checking plumage and things. And
absolutely. And the males spend about 90% of their time for 9 months of the year dancing. So the females have plenty of opportunity to check them out.
I'm very grateful that that's not the case with human beings, since I would be single still, I think, if my dancing was anything to go by. But is it a rule that you followed in your own life? Have you been turned on by gentlemen who are good movers on the floor?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I think that a man that can dance, that's something very special. In fact, when my husband was courting me, he went to great lengths to tell me how he would be delighted to take me dancing.
And it's led your passion for dance, Nicky, to another unusual aspect of your career, because you're the first scientist in residence at the Rombert Dance Company. What does that involve you in?
Yes, well, I've been collaborating with Mark Baldwin, who's the artistic director of Rombert, since January 2009, in fact. And the first piece I worked with Mark on was called Comedy of Change, which was in honour of Charles Darwin's bicentenary and the 150th anniversary of his very influential book on the origin of the species. So we talked about the biological nature of change, which is what Darwin's theory of natural and sexual selection is all about. It's the idea that individuals vary, and those that are the best adapted to the current environment are the ones that are most likely to survive, and that females choose to mate with the fittest, sexiest males, which produce more offspring, and that in turn they survive better and get the best pickings. And that was a sort of lovely idea with which to explore the choreography behind the piece.
I'm very pleased to say that one of my composer colleagues provided the music, a very, very good composer, Julian Anderson.
And Julian knows so much about birdsong, so we had some fascinating discussions about how birds learn their songs and all the different varieties of bird calls and songs.
Well, here's section five of Julian Anderson's Comedy of Change.
Thank you.
Alan Gilbert conducting the New York Philharmonic Orchestra in the fifth section of Julian Anderson's 2009 piece, Comedy of Change. And by the way, you can get all the details of the music that are played in the programme, chosen by Nicky Clayton, on the Private Passions page of the Radio 3 website. We've been talking a great deal about your work on birds, but your scientific exploration really goes a lot wider than that. And I think you've also published the results of experiments with young children. Did you discover anything fascinating about children in the way that you have about birds?
Yes, well, absolutely. We've adapted quite a few of the tasks that we've used for the crows for children, because it's about trying to tap into how young children think before their language has come online. So one experiment we did was to ask whether they can plan for tomorrow and when that develops in the young children. And we were able to show that little children of three are not able to plan, whereas children of four start developing it, and by five they're pretty good. And we were also able to show that actually young children find it much harder to plan for what they think they will themselves want in the future than what another little boy or girl just like them will want. So when you add me into the equation, bizarrely enough, it's actually harder, not easier, to solve the task. And I think the reason for that is that what you have to do to solve that task is to ignore what I want now and think about what I will want in the future. You don't have to worry about what I want now is when you're making decisions for what another little boy or girl or what another person just like you will want.
You're particularly interested in memory, aren't you, in what you call mental time travel, which I think you feel is the key not only to identity but also to creativity?
That's right. So it's the ability to remember the past and to plan for the future. We don't remember everything that's happened. We're extremely selective in what we choose to remember, those things that we find surprising and interesting by and large. And then each time we revisit our memories, we don't simply replay them, but we actually end up recreating them and changing them in subtle ways depending on our mood and point of view. And that's what makes it so interesting, both scientifically and artistically, because it's not an accurate record of what happened, but it's shaped by how we see the world, hence identity. And the way in which we constantly recreate and do this perspective taking to look at nuances on what really happened is part of what makes us creative.
And in terms of what's actually happening in the brain as we're making memories, I think that idea leads to your next piece.
The next piece of music that I've chosen, and I've long considered it to be beautiful, seems to go through the same process that the brain goes through when it's making its memories, when it's engaged in this mental time travel that we've been talking about. So it lays itself out almost, in my mind, like an electrophysiological recording of the activity of neurons in the brain, a series of spikes of electrical activity.
And this second part of Taras Bulba by Leos Janacek is, I think, for you a particularly potent example of that. Taras Bulba was a rhapsody for orchestra composed between 1915 and 18. It's one of Janacek's most powerful works, and it's based on the novel by Gogol.
Thank you. Thank you.
That was the death of Ostap, Taras Bulba's son, from the second part of Taras Bulba by Leos Janacek. And we heard that great messiah for Janacek, Charles Mackerras, conducting the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. We talked about your collaboration with Rombert, Nicky Clayton, but you've also been working with a painter, Clive Wilkins.
He's artist and a writer, and he's artist in residence in the Department of Psychology at Cambridge. And we've got a blog site called The Captured Thought that talks about our arts and science collaboration. Clive's the author of a series of books, The Mustachio Quartet, and they explore the subjective experience of thinking. So they're all about mental time travel and consciousness and what it means to be human beings, the way we think. And there's one particularly haunting chapter in the second book, which is called Count Zapik. It's about a particular character who's a magician called Count Zapik, but it's really about the way he thinks, the way he perceives himself through time. And the short extract that I want to read is about a little bellboy who's just about to go to sleep on the top of the roof. As he lay, looking up above and into the stars, he dreamily watched them pass by at their own speed, not like the shooting stars, but at the speed the universe moves itself around the sun. Gaspard sensed he was right next to them by virtue of being on top of the high roof. He floated above reality, lost in time or beyond time, beneath the sky, but above the earth, not really sleeping yet, although just about to be, abandoned in a space between one place and another.
And this is very much inspired, this writing, isn't it, by Maurice Ravel's Gaspard de la Nuit, that wonderful piano
Absolutely.
Piece.
When I questioned Clive about it, he said that actually the ideas are entirely from this piece of music.
Thank you.
Le gibet, the gibbet, the central movement of Ravel's Gaspard de la Nuit. The pianist was Pascal Roger. We were talking about music as an ultimate beauty. And as a scientist, Nicky Clayton, I wonder how much you are alert to the beauty of the world through science or independent of it.
That's an interesting question. I think both. I think that the dance side of me has sort of helped me integrate science and arts in interesting ways that allows me to see multiple perspectives. But I do think that also there's a real beauty in science. I think that very often people tend to think that it's artists are creative and scientists measure things. And I think that that's an unfair distinction, because I think that artists also are interested in measuring things.
Well, I mean, you could not write a piece of music without a technical grasp on mathematics in the way the music is assembled.
Precisely. And I think equally, to be a really good scientist, you have to be creative.
To make that leap.
To make the leap, and also to design some of these experiments requires a real elegance and a creativity, because it's not easy getting into the head of a crow.
Darwin actually wrote about the beauty of birds, didn't he?
Yes, very
much so. He liked stroke
so.
Them, too.
He talks as well in great detail about the birds of paradise and their wonderful showy displays and how beautiful they are.
OK, now here's an even more difficult question. Do you think birds themselves have a sense of beauty? Do they appreciate the beauty of the earth and sky or of each other?
Well, I suspect they do. Of course, you know, I could say, well, it depends what you mean by beauty. But they're certainly very, very sensitive to symmetry, and they're sensitive to colours and sounds. You only need to see that in some of these displays where the females are extremely choosy in which males they select. And very often it's the ones that are the most eloquent and elegant and exuberant.
Well, of course, that takes us back to natural selection, doesn't it? And the way things breed in and breed out in order to be chosen, in order to procreate.
Absolutely. And if you watch the birds of paradise, you can see these little guys trying to learn the form, and the females are just not impressed. And then the maestro comes along, and all of a sudden they're queuing in the first circle, if you like. And then, you know, it's the gorgeous guy with the showy displays that gets all the girls at the end of the day.
In terms of making a musical song yourself, you actually played the clarinet when you were at Oxford, didn't you?
Yes, I still play the clarinet, but not as much as I would like these days. That's right. I played in the Oxford Symphony Orchestra as a young postdoctoral researcher. And the piece I've chosen, it might seem a strange piece in a way, although I do think it's very powerful and moving, is Bruckner's Symphony No. 9, and it was the last symphony on which he worked. And it's just one of those pieces that I keep coming back to time and time again.
Thank you.
There's nothing quite like Nicky Clayton playing that music in an orchestra, is there?
Oh, it was amazing. Yeah.
That feeling of ensemble, that need to listen to other people.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, there's three clarinets, not the usual two in Bruckner.
Carlo Maria Giulini conducting the Vienna Philharmonic in the opening of Bruckner's Ninth Symphony. Have you ever tried playing the clarinet to birds?
I haven't. I think they'd be quite frightened of it, in a way.
Yeah. Or have you ever played any music to them or sung to them?
Well, there's a very famous parrot all over YouTube, no doubt, called Snowball. He's a sulphur-crested cockatoo, and he actually dances in time to the music. And it's very funny to watch him, actually, because he's got a really good sense of rhythm. I've had the pleasure of dancing with him, actually, at the World Congress of Science in New York.
Does your husband know about this?
Absolutely, yes. He was there watching.
Enviously.
Exactly. But Snowball doesn't share my taste in music, so I don't think Nathan's got anything to worry about, really. Snowball's penchant is for the Backstreet Boys.
And how does he actually make movement? Just explain for people who have not seen YouTube.
Yeah, it's really funny. He literally dances. So he stands on a perch and he sort of hops up and down, lifting up one claw and then the other, and he bobs his head and he sort of wiggles his tail area, and you can really see him sort of moving in time to the music. It's absolutely fantastic. And every now and again, he'll start trying to sing in tune with the Backstreet Boys as well. And of course, as is true with any of us, the moment you try and multitask, that's when things can go a bit pear-shaped. So if he ever loses rhythm, it's only when he starts trying to sing and then he rapidly regains the beat again. Bless.
Well, Nicky Clayton, thank you so much for telling us all of these extraordinary things about birds, which I'm sure will be news to many people, but very fascinating news. And therefore, I think it would be awfully nice to play you out, as we began, with a little bit more birdsong. How would that be?
Why, thank you. Delightful.
Call of the Reed Warbler, ending today's Private Passions. Michael's guest this week was the scientist Nicky Clayton. The producer was Elizabeth Burke for Loftus. And you can download that programme and a good many more if you go to the Radio 3 podcasts page. Next week, Michael's guest is the Deputy President of the Supreme Court, Lady Brenda Hale. That's here on BBC Radio 3 next Sunday at midday. Well, in a couple of minutes, our lunchtime concert. Pianist Stephen Osborne at London's Wigmore Hall in a selection of Rachmaninoff Etude Tableau and the whole of Mussorgsky's pictures at an exhibition. It's 1 o'clock. The news now read by David Cornett.
Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko says progress has been made during telephone negotiations with the leaders of France, Germany and Russia aimed at resolving the crisis in eastern Ukraine. Another summit is scheduled to take place on Wednesday in the Belarusian capital, Minsk. Earlier, the Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, warned that the proposed deal was one of the last opportunities for Russia to avoid further economic damage. The government is extending until mid-May the Pensioner Bonds Scheme, which offers generous rates to savers over the age of 65. But there's been criticism from the Institute for Economic Affairs, which says working people are subsidising well-off pensioners. Nigeria's main opposition party, the APC, has condemned the 6-week postponement of the presidential election to the end of March, describing the move as a major setback for democracy. But the Electoral Commission said the threat of Boko Haram attacks greatly jeopardised the prospects of a fair poll, as well as the safety of workers, of voters and election observers. Iran has indicated that it's prepared to end negotiations on its nuclear programme if agreement can't be reached by a deadline set for the end of June. The country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, said no deal would be better than a bad deal. Police attending the scene of a stabbing in East London last night were pelted with bottles and other missiles. Scotland Yard says officers in Hackney were threatened by around 30 people. An 18-year-old man is being held on suspicion of affray and possessing an offensive weapon. The Prince of Wales has been speaking to Syrian refugees during a visit to a refugee camp in Jordan. The Prince is on the first day of a six-day tour of the Middle East. An edition of the Magna Carta, which could be worth up to £10 million, has been discovered in Kent. The document, issued in the year 1300, had lain forgotten in council archives in Maidstone, but belongs to the town of Sandwich. And the weather, another largely dry day with some sunny spells. The best of the sunshine will probably be in the east and the south of the UK. Top temperatures 6 Celsius in Belfast, Cardiff and Edinburgh, and 8 in London. BBC News and weather at 1:02.
And it was read by David Cornett. Well, now on Radio 3, another chance to hear a concert given last Monday lunchtime. It's presented by Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to a packed Wigmore Hall in central London for a recital by Stephen Osborne, one of the very first Radio 3 new generation artists and now widely considered one of the greatest pianists of his generation. 2 years ago, he brought out a recording of Mussorgsky's pictures at an exhibition to rave reviews, and he's playing the whole colourful cycle in today's concert. But he's starting with four studies by another composer whose work he's recorded and become known as a great interpreter of, Rachmaninoff. He's going to play four of his études tableaux, which are also musical pictures like Mussorgsky's, but these are ones which Rachmaninoff didn't give titles to, keeping the images that he had in mind when writing them a secret. Here to play four of Rachmaninoff's Etudes Tableaux from the Opus 33 set is the pianist Stephen Osborne.